Devoncast
from Radio X.
Welcome to Devoncast, another edition, another week. Thank you for listening. Thank you for choosing us to accompany your dog walk or whatever you're doing. We'll talk politics, we'll talk local politics, national politics, the big issues, the things that affect you, the things that have got you talking all over Devon. I'm Guy Henderson.
And I'm Ali Stevenson.
We have a packed Devoncast for you as ever, after what's been a very newsy couple of weeks in our lovely county. In no particular order, we've got power to the people over parking meters, there's trouble on Dartmoor, we've got the latest on devolution for Devon, and there's turmoil at Torquay United. We've got a palaver over palm trees and an arresting day out at the police museum. All this and more. But first, I've been taking a look at a little revolution which is going on right here in South Devon. I've been covering general elections since 1979. You remember that night when Margaret Thatcher first got the keys to number 10. I interviewed a distraught Ray Morby in 1983 on the night he was told the Totnes Conservative Association didn't want him to be their candidate anymore and they wanted Anthony Steen instead. But not much has changed over the years until now. Now there's a pungent whiff of revolution in the air. An organisation called South Devon Primary has set out to topple sitting Totnes Conservative MP Anthony Magnall by uniting so-called progressive opposition voters behind a single candidate who'll be a kind of people's champion. Mr Magnall isn't engaging with it. He says it's undemocratic, but then he would say that because the South Devon Primary is a movement dedicated to sending him packing. Here's how it works. Mr Magnall won by nearly 13,000 votes last time out in 2019, but the pundits predict a much closer contest this time. Trade union firebrand Henry Vivian was the constituency's last non-conservative MP and he lost his seat in 1924. The banner at the front of the stage for the primary's town hall meeting in Paignton the other night read, "Let's end 100 years of conservative MPs in Totnes." So it was no surprise really that Mr Magnall chose to stay away. The idea is to gather progressive candidates from the centre and left-leaning parties for a series of public meetings across the patch and let an audience of voters grill them for a couple of hours. As they leave the venue, audience members cast votes for their preferred candidates, and when all seven town hall meetings have been completed, the votes get totted up. A winner will be declared and that person will be hailed the People's Champion for South Devon. The idea then is that everyone who wants to see Mr Magnall ousted gets behind the champ as a kind of unified opposition, even if the champ represents a party they wouldn't normally vote for. Liberal Democrat Caroline Vodden and Green Party candidate Robert Bagnall are doing the rounds of the primary town hall meetings. Along with Mr Magnall, two other parties were also absent. Labour has yet to select a candidate for the seat and has said it doesn't want to be part of the primary process anyway. Reform UK wasn't invited because there didn't seem to be any point. The party positions itself to the right of the Tories, so there would be few shared values to discuss with those on the platform. At Paignton, the two candidates spent 2 hours answering questions on subjects ranging from climate change and immigration to taxation and the controversial Plymouth Freeport project. Afterwards, both agreed that the exercise had been well worthwhile.
Oh, absolutely. Anything that puts us in front of voters enables us to explain our thinking, where we're coming from, what we're standing for, I think is absolutely vital. You know, too much politics is done, through things like social media and the echo chamber of Facebook and what have you. So being able to connect with people directly, and it's a lot quicker than, you know, talking to 200 people is a lot quicker than knocking on 200 doors. You know, I think it's great for democracy.
Well, it's really useful for two reasons. One is because we get to talk to lots of voters at one time. So, you know, talking to 100 voters in a room is quicker than finding 100 on the doorsteps. And also it's really useful to hear what people's concerns are and what they're worried about. And, you know, it's going to be very interesting over seven hustings to see which questions pop up every time and which ones are kind of outliers.
So I wanted to know, are we really witnessing a political revolution right here in Devon?
It's reaching a lot of people and it's being talked about. It's good for democracy. I do know it's scaring some of the bigger parties. Obviously, Labour have been scared off. I don't know what they've got to be scared of. You know, we're just the candidates representing ourselves. Yeah. You know, why would anyone not want to take part in this?
I think we're just so tired of the first past the post system. You know, it just doesn't work. And it's not democratic. And for smaller parties like the Lib Dems and the Greens, it's really hard to break through in that system. And I think this is really interesting because it is trying to find a way through that. And just trying to do things differently. And, you know, we've got to give it a go. And if it's going to work anywhere, it'll work in South Devon, Totnes. You know, it's lots of good ideas have been born here.
And so I asked them, what happens if you lose when the votes are totted up? Will it change the way you conduct your campaign?
No, it won't. We'll still be out there knocking on doors. It's absolutely vital to have a green option on the ballot paper. I think you'll probably get a slightly different answer from Caroline than me, simply because, I mean, I think the degree of funding for the parties and the degree to which we can carry out a campaign, this is not a target seat for the Greens. I don't think I'm giving anything away by saying that. So, you know, there is a limited expectation on a Green campaign. And really, the Green campaign is as much about getting the green idea into people's minds for future campaigns, which, we, you know, explains my remarks at the end. And I have had feedback, or I've heard feedback from Lib Dems saying, you know, it's a little weird, isn't it, that he's trailing future elections, you know, as well as talking about this one. But, you know, the Greens have to build up momentum from a low base. But as I said, every election we go to, we do better. You know, if you look at a graph of our Green councillors, it's like the first days of COVID. It's just gone vertical.
Well, I'm hoping that I will win, and it'll change my campaign in so much as it'll just turbo boost what is already a really strong, exciting campaign. You know, we're already seen as the challengers here, and winning this will just reinforce that. People quite often open the door now and say, oh, hello, I know who you are. You know, they've seen my face on lots of bits of paper. They've seen me on the telly. And I think it's exciting.
Afterwards, I spoke to South Devon Primary's Anthea Simmons to get an idea what it's all about.
Right, this is all about putting voting power back in people's hands and reminding them that they have a democratic right that they must exercise. And I think in seats that are safe seats, or stale seats, people give up voting. You know, the biggest cohort of people after those who voted Tory last time were people who didn't register to vote but didn't bother because they think it's a fait accompli. So what we're doing is we're saying, come on, you know, if we all are clever and vote together, we can have a different outcome. I mean, overall, we're talking about 1,500 to 2,000 people voting, you know, and coming along to meetings. They really, really are. I mean, there was a great article in the Times, full page in the Times, full page in iNews. iNews said that there's a little revolution happening on the banks of the Dart. And we're getting, you know, inquiries from people saying, oh, can we run a primary here? You know, people are sick of being detached from it all, actually. They want to get involved, but that means they have to meet the politicians. That's what makes a big difference.
As I set out to go to the meeting, somebody said to me, of course, you know, this is all funded by the Lib Dems, don't you? So I asked, is it?
It is absolutely not funded by the Lib Dems. No, it is not. All three of us have voted tactically over the years. I actually used to be a Tory voter till 2015, but none of us are members of any party, and it has not, absolutely not come from the Lib Dems. I can categorically tell you that. Onwards and upwards, yeah. This is the face of new politics.
So the voices you heard during that were those of Green candidate Robert Bagnall, Liberal Democrat Caroline Vodon, and South Devon primary organiser Anthea Simmons. Still to come on the Devoncast, he said, reaching for his notebook, we've got devolution in Devon, we've got Dartmoor National Park finances, Torquay United, we talk about the Exmouth Seawall project, palm trees, Marie Curie doing some fundraising, and a look around the police museum. But first, Ali, it's parking meters.
Yes, it is. And controversial plans for those meters in eight of Devon's towns look set to be dropped next Wednesday after more than 5,000 people told Devon County Council exactly how they felt about them. Campaigners are delighted that the county seems to have backed down in their plans, which many have criticised as just a money-making exercise. Tavistock was the most vocal in the opposition, fearing that the move would kill the high street. And it led the fight with over half of the representations to the public consultation coming from the West Devon town alone. Despite Devon County saying that the meters would cause a better turnover or churn of cars and shoppers, as people would have to stick to their 1 hour of free parking, pay for more or get a fine. Tavistock's Business Improvement District conducted its own survey to prove turnover was already pretty good, with an average stay time of 28 minutes. County Councillor for Tavistock, Debo Sellis, gave her backing to the Stop the Meters campaign. Here she is, responding to the latest news.
I'm thrilled that the councillors have listened. The people have had their voices heard. I am really pleased. The relief is indescribable. I'd actually wanted to have a roundtable meeting because parking is such a huge issue. We've got issues with residents wanting parking. We've got off-street, on-street, and that just could not be made in a decision made in isolation. So common sense has prevailed, and I'm absolutely thrilled.
That was Councillor Debo Sellis there. And more than 100 people turned out to a public meeting in Tavistock last week on the issue. Town Centre Manager Jana Sanders told me why she thought the meters were a bad idea.
Well, fundamentally, it could change the way the high street is in Tavistock. It's going to change the way people shop. It changes the ease of use that they currently enjoy, encouraging them to come into the town centre. It's a tax on people in a cost of living crisis. People can't afford to pay for parking. They just want to pop in and go to the veg shop and to the butchers and to support the businesses that they know and love. It's really important for the older people that the community serves. They won't be able to go and find a meter and remember their registration and pop that in, and they'll change the way they shop. And then that affects their, you know, their mental health, because they enjoy coming in and they enjoy seeing people that they know in Tavistock Town Centre. We're a World Heritage Site. It could affect our World Heritage status. There are so many reasons. I mean, I could go on and on and on. Those are just a few. But really, you know, it just isn't what we need in Tavistock.
That was Tavistock Town Centre Manager Jana Sanders, who's probably having a well-earned rest after the big campaign that she's led. So the Cabinet meeting next week will recommend not to proceed with the parking meters. Devon County Council leader John Hart said many of our towns have parking and congestion issues which need to be tackled, but it's important that any solution has the support of the local community. We are listening to them, he said.
That's great, isn't it? I saw a report on this somewhere where it's power to the people. It's a real victory, isn't it?
Yeah, so that was my report, I think. Power to yeah, absolutely, people power. And you know, yeah. People sometimes think they're actually not going to achieve anything, but it just tells you, you know, get it in numbers, and yeah. You know, you do actually make an impact. So yeah, this is the second time Tavi's been quite ruthless with their campaigning. They stopped a Premier Inn coming in a few years back, and yeah. Now they stopped the meter. So I think they're on a high right now.
And it's good for us, really. These are stories that we've been talking about for a few weeks now. We've got another one coming up a little bit later on as well. But it's nice to have a story that we sort of get started with, and we get the campaign going, and and we hear from the campaigners.
Yeah.
And that's almost a full stop after it, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, it's very satisfying.
Here's another story that we talked about quite a bit, but devolution is coming for Devon. With Devon County Council and Torbay Council joining together to form one mighty combined county authority. This is happening as we speak. The government says it'll make a big difference for the county, unlocking millions of pounds in new investment. But the two councils, it's important to point this out, will retain their own identities despite the new deal. They'll just have a bigger bargaining say. All the other local authorities in Devon will be in line to benefit too, with the exception of Plymouth, because they didn't want to be part of it. Radio X's Paul Nero, who's been out this morning, has been out talking to Devon County Council Cabinet Member Rufus Gilbert and Exeter City Council Leader Phil Bialik all about it.
So we're in the middle of a consultation for this devolution deal. Rufus, what does it mean for a county?
The greater good, surmising, really. It's good to have a plan move forward that involves addressing the enormous issues that we all face, housing, the economy, and working together more closely to bring a greater and better quality decisions for the future to the benefit of all the communities of Devon.
People would be saying you should be doing that already. This is just another layer of bureaucracy.
Well, we should always try our best, and we could perhaps always do a little bit better, and this is why we are going down this road, because this is another way of doing just that, doing it better.
Phil, you're a representative of Exeter City Council and therefore at district level. There are only two seats on the board of this combined authority for the 8 districts in Devon. Will that give you significant weight in this new authority?
Well, I always say, you know, when I go to a meeting, you'll always hear my voice and the voice of the districts. And common sense always prevails, whether they vote or not on it. Now, look, this is a very important moment for Devon. We need to make sure that government, of whatever shade that comes about, understands that Devon is an important key element to our economy here in the southwest. We're not just a quaint little area where people come on holiday. We are quite in the forefront of things. Exeter, for example, with something like 7 of the world's top climate scientists based at Exeter University. You must understand that we are an important part of the region and also of the area. Now, this deal will bring down powers, not suck up powers, and that's what's so important. We want government to let go of some of the things and give that power down to local people here in Devon. We've got some great proposals for housing, skills. We need to keep young graduates and our children in Devon, but of course they want good transport links and they want good housing, and more importantly, they want high-value jobs. That's what we're committed to doing.
Rufus, Phil's a Labour councillor, you're a Conservative. It sounds like you're speaking in harmony here.
Yes, we do, but then I had the greatest respect for Phil as a leader of Exeter. You only got to look around Exeter and see what a great place it is. So, once again, I think Phil's got it right, and he's wrapped it up very well, and I totally agree with everything he's just said.
What's the most pressing issue?
I think transport and housing. The two are connected. You need housing in our communities, but if you haven't got good transport links, you just have isolation of people, and we can't have that. But then, of course, it comes good education facilities, good local facilities for hospitals, doctor surgeries, transportation, a cultural offer. There's a lot for us to do as local politicians to look after our people in Devon.
Housing, a district matter, transport, health, and education, a county matter. Will this ease the decision-making if it happens, Rufus?
Well, that's the plan, ultimately. I mean, my division, where I'm elected area is Salcombe, and boy, do we have a housing issue down there. In the budget yesterday, the Chancellor brought forward some good proposals, which is trying to get the housing market away from Airbnbs and holiday lets, more towards local people being able to rent those houses. And I hope that will work and that more of the people where I live, relatively affluent area, obviously, but a mixed, that they will finally get an opportunity to be able to rent a house that they need so much so.
But also reduces the amount available for tourism.
Well, that is partly so, but there has to be a balance, clearly, doesn't there? I mean, you can't just have everything orientated towards one industry, and it's no point anyway. It's a workers, people trying to earn a livelihood, can't service those businesses. If the restaurants can't get staff, the issue, there is a balance between it, and we need to bring it back into balance.
We're in consultation. What do you want people to do, Phil?
I want people to respond to that survey that's going out from the County Council. We need to hear their views in a positive way and in an informative way. Devon is so important to us all that we work collaboratively across all the sectors and agencies, and I'm great to say we've always been doing that, funny enough, with the local authorities, regardless of political party, and I know that we will continue to do it, and that is my message to government. You need to listen to us down here in Devon.
That was Exeter City Council leader Phil Bialik talking to Paul Nero from Radio X, also involved in that interview, Devon County Council Cabinet Member Rufus Gilbert. Interesting. Devolution, it's taking shape, isn't it? Nobody quite knows exactly what it's going to be.
No. Everybody feels, I think, that somebody said we have to be in the tent this week rather than outside of it. So, I think, you know, they want to see the benefits of it, but they're really not sure at the moment how it's going to be run or, you know.
I love that phrase about the tent, by the way. There's a very rude expression about being inside and outside tents that I'm not going to do on the podcast, obviously. But I think it was Julian Brazil at South Hams Council that I first heard say it's very important to be inside the tent looking out rather than outside the tent looking in, which is quite a clever adaptation of, yeah. of a very rude phrase. But there you go. If you want to see it that way, see it that way. We've got plenty coming up still on the podcast. We'll be talking Talker United in a bit. We're down on the Exmouth seawall. There are palm trees. Well, the palm trees came down in Torquay just before Christmas, and there's a report just been published which explains why. We'll get to that in a bit
look
as well.
Look forward to that one.
And we've got the police museum still to come. But first, Dartmoor National Park Authority. You got to go to the Dartmoor National Park Authority.
Yeah, well, this was an absolute treat, I have to say. Guy normally covers that patch, but I had the opportunity to go because he was away. Yippee. And and it actually felt like I was having a day out as I crossed the moors from Mam Tavistock to Bobby Tracy. Absolutely beautiful drive if anyone's never done it before. And I was made to feel very welcome.
It's a nice meeting, isn't it?
Really nice. Had a press bench now or a press table, not had one of those for a long time, so I felt, you know, quite important.
We feel looked after at Dartmoor National Park, don't we?
I even got a cup of tea, but I'm not really supposed to mention that, but I thought I would anyway. Thank you. It was just a special treat. They got down to serious business. Lots of newsworthy items for me to write about there. And it was clear that Dartmoor National Park Authority is feeling the pinch like every other authority in the country, with government funding not going far enough. Despite high inflation rises, which peaked at 11% in 2022, the park's guardians have not had an increase in funding since 2019, which was the year before the world changed.
Didn't it just?
Yeah, absolutely. So during the lunch break, I sat down with Dartmoor National Park Authority's chairperson, Pamela Woods, who told me about the crisis facing the authority, which currently has very few ways of bringing in cash to look after the nature, the 2.3 million visitors to the moor each year, and the people who live there.
We haven't had a cost of living increase on our grant, our central grant that we get from DEFRA annually for a number of years. So this means really that an income which should be at in excess of 7-8 million a year is at the moment barely almost 4 million a year. So you can see what the funding gap is. But nevertheless, the cost of living goes up. The items that we use, the personnel that we pay, those costs go up. So clearly the gap closes.
So what are you going to be saying to the Secretary of State when you have a meeting with him?
What we'd like the Secretary of State to consider is that an offer that's been made to National Parks of a £500,000 one-off capital grant could, in our case, be changed to a revenue grant. I mean, our preference is for that to be built into core grants and for it to be granted to us on a repeat basis. But if that's not possible, at least on a one-year basis would be very welcome. We have two fundamental purposes. One is to conserve the natural environment and all that goes with it on National Park. And the second one is to use the National Park to inform and educate people at large, if you like, from all walks of society, to enjoy and be informed by the National Park. We also have a further duty to make sure that we consider the livelihoods and the conditions of people who live and work in the park. So we've got three audiences, really. We've got nature, we've got our visitors, and we've actually got the people who live and work here. Now, our ability to carry out those fundamental functions, those central functions, is being eroded year on year, and we are fast reaching a critical point where further cuts, which will be necessary, will actually bite into our delivery on those purposes. Sure, we can have extra projects, which I should say are externally funded, not funded from within that core budget from DEFRA. But once you have to bite away at core resources, and that includes the staff available to make grant applications for external funding, it will bite away at the staff required to carry out those central purposes. you start to look at the diminution of the effectiveness of national parks. And Dartmoor is very much affected by those cuts.
So what you were saying there is you don't have any council tax, that doesn't come into it. It's, you're different from a council in that respect. You don't have any commercial projects to bring in money. So for you, it's particularly difficult to find that extra cash that you might need.
Yes, we'll have to carry out a business review. If there is no improvement to core funding, we will have to carry out a business review, and that will be to look at all aspects of our activities. Mm-hmm. We're not able to raise council tax. Dartmoor of itself has very, very few assets which you could either sell or raise money on, other than the ones that you actually saw in our fees and charges paper that we considered today. So our revenue raising ability is very, very limited.
So if people didn't have the National Park Authority looking after the park, what difference would they see?
There wouldn't be an overview. And I think that this is probably one of the most important things, the most important aspects of a national park, that it gives you the powers to take a holistic view of what happens in the park, what happens on to the environment, impact of climate change, the way that the land is used and managed, and the way that people are housed and services provided for them on the moor. We are the authority, as the authority, that has that overview that can bring all these aspects together, not forgetting, of course, our very many visitors who come every year to enjoy, be informed and understand more about nature, more about the park.
In a way, you're looking after it for the future.
Indeed, we are looking after it for the future. You will have seen in debates earlier today how important it is to balance the interests of our, for example, our medieval landscape with modern day needs of people. And that's one of our jobs, to try to achieve a proper balance between those things.
That was Pamela Woods. He'll be pleading Dartmoor National Parks Authority's case for extra cash when she meets with Secretary of State for Food, Environment and Rural Affairs, Steve Barclay, next week.
It's such a special place, though, Dartmoor, isn't it? And it's got that the overview, the authority takes that overview. Without the authority, you kind of worry that it wouldn't be safeguarded in quite the way it is.
I think a lot of people think, oh, you know, what is the point of them? They're not a council. They don't, you know, provide services in the same way, but they do, but they're just much more in the background. So they're sort of doing a lot of schemes for the environment, you know, conservation projects, saving, you know, rare animals and working and managing them all with the rangers and that kind of thing. And it's, yeah, it would look very different if they weren't around.
And the planning committee part of the authority is really important, because the number of times that they get somebody who wants to build something out of Grand Designs in the middle of Dartmoor.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, I've been to a couple of their meetings where they're so thorough with the view of this proposed development from miles and miles away really matters.
It is a really difficult one. There was a planning application last week. It's similar, you know, people wanted to convert old barns that had, you know, been redundant for years into a house. But these, you know, they were worried it was going to change the face of the landscape, you know, by having cars driving through the, you know, old tracks, and, you know, the barn wouldn't quite be the same. But then again, some of the members were worried that, you know, the officers were just maybe letting the barns fall down. That was the alternative. So, you know, what do you do? It's very difficult.
You only get one chance with somewhere like Dartmoor, don't you?
Yeah.
If you allow building on it, it's gone.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Important, and a thoroughly good meeting to be part of.
Yeah, really good. Well. Yeah.
A little bit later on, we'll be talking about Exmouth at the seawall. We'll be talking about Torquay's palm trees, and we'll be visiting a new police museum. But first, Ali, this is a subject very close to my heart. Torquay United Football Club. I'm a season ticket holder. They're playing tomorrow.
I don't know what to say, because I don't share guys' love of football.
You're not a big football fan. Tavistock have got a very, very good
team.
Well,
they have. I have written about Tavistock, but trying to write a sports report is very difficult for a news reporter if you know nothing about football. But I did attempt it once.
That's all you need to do. So it's now just over 2 weeks since Torquay United owner Clark Osborne decided he'd had enough of the English Riviera. Unable to persuade Torquay Council to part with the freehold of Playmore, which it very definitely won't do, he announced that he could no longer support the club financially and would have to prepare it for administration. That's a terrible word for a football club, administration, because it brings with it, you lose points, people are fearful about their jobs, you know, the players and the staff, you know, they're all, when you look at it as a business, they're all employees of a company that's being put into administration. It's not in administration yet. And yesterday there was an announcement that the club has got another 10 working days to try and find a buyer before it goes into administration. And there's a possibility of an extension beyond that as well. So it's not quite doom and gloom yet. But the interesting part of this from our local democracy point of view is that Torquay Council owns the freehold to Playmore and won't part with it. Clark Osborne has always said he wanted it so that he could build houses there and move the club out to a brand new stadium out on the outskirts of town. The video that they showed of the brand new stadium looked fantastic. It was probably never going to happen. But, you know, there's an impasse there. And we don't know for sure because everybody keeps confidentiality, but we're assuming that there was a final meeting where Clark Osborne went to the council and said, look, these are our plans for a stadium, but in order to do them, we need to do this, this and this with Playmore. And the council said once and for all, look, you're not having Playmore. And, you know, we speculate that that probably was the final straw. But it's been interesting. There was a Torquay Council meeting shortly after the administration was announced. So what comes next? Here's Torquay Council leader David Thomas speaking in the council meeting about the subject. And he's followed by Liberal Democrat group leader Steve Darling, both talking on the future of the club and the future of Playmore.
For local football at all levels is an important part of our community. And we want to reassure the club and its supporters that we will engage with any interested parties to understand how we might support the ongoing operation of the club. The manager of the club rang me probably about an hour ago to update me with the latest situation. And I think one of the questions that will be keen on the lips of everybody within Torbay is the freehold. The freehold of the club is held by this council. We have long held a position that it remained with the council. Nothing has changed as of that particular point. Our position is still exactly as it was previously.
To many of us who have been followers of the club, this is sadly something that had haunted our dreams for many months, that we could be in this situation. And I know that I've only just spoken to fellow members of the Overview and Scrutiny Board, or at least a couple of them, this afternoon, who've expressed their concerns on this issue. And I reflected with Councillor Cowell that we had raised this previously with officers, that if the club found itself in a challenge, that we must be ready to see how we can stand by and support them. So sadly, it's no surprise. I'll be agendering this as an item for our Overview and Scrutiny Board to see how we're able to assist. But equally, I've received emails from fans and locals this afternoon raising their concerns about the future of Playmore. And clearly, I'm pleased to hear from Councillor Thomas the reassurance, but I'm keen to ensure that football continues to be played there and it continues to be played there by Torquay United, and we need to stand by the club and their supporters at this difficult time.
So that was Councillor Dave Thomas, the council leader, and then after him, Councillor Steve Darling. Pretty unequivocal there. Playmore is not for sale, and the council will do what it can to help the club over this hurdle that it's in at the moment. If nothing else, the club pays a not inconsiderable rent to Torquay Council, so there's a financial involvement from both sides there. interesting times ahead. One more councillor. I had a chat with independent group leader on Torbay Council, Darren Cowell. No stranger to the terraces himself. I actually saw him over on the pop side, which is the popular terrace at Plainmoor, just after we spoke.
I'm glad you explained that.
Statement from the leader of the council tonight provides reassurance that the freehold is not up for discussion. And I think that is a solid starting point for any discussions we have with any future potential club owners.
And it's very important in the short term to keep football at Plainmoor and to do what can be done to support the club.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, how that manifests itself in terms of direct support for the club is something that I'll start conversations with colleagues already said that we need to talk about it quickly so that we know that if there is a fans-based consortium that comes forward, that we can consider that it may not be as commercially viable as the current arrangements.
But still, the council is there to do what it can to support the football club.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've always said, as long as I'm around, I'm absolutely determined that Plainmoor will be the home of Torquay United until the fans and the club itself are in a position to move forward. Personally, I can't see that happening for many, many, many years. Key thing is to try and get the club back into the Football League and to support whoever comes in with Torquay United.
Darren Cowell, councillor, and Torquay United fan talking about the future of the club.
So one question, Guy.
Mm-hmm.
You going to buy it?
Can't quite scrape together enough. I don't. Well, I don't know how much it's on the market for. The previous owner has a lot of money invested in it. How much, if any, of that he's going to get back, who knows? So the funny thing is, everybody who's involved in this has signed non-disclosure agreements as part of the deal. I understand there are three parties talking about potentially buying the club, but they've all signed NDAs. The club has signed an NDA, so no news is coming out at the moment. Lots of rumour.
Oh, well, but fingers crossed, eh?
No actual news.
Right, so we're heading down to the coast. Delayed emergency repairs to Exmouth seawall that has been due to start in January are now going to begin in the next 2 weeks. But costs have skyrocketed to £4 million, and part of the project is being pushed back until the autumn. Here's Councillor Jeff Young of East Devon District Council talking to our colleague Will Goddard about the situation on Wednesday. The repairs will see part of the seawall near the Sideshore Water Sports Development replaced with steel sheets piles at first. These will have cladding at a later date. The works are happening because the section of the wall has no foundations and low beach levels have allowed waves to wash out sand from underneath, putting it at risk of collapse.
Interesting. It's nice, Exmouth. The seafront at Exmouth is a proper jewel in the crown, isn't it? They've got to get that right. I'd be interested to see how that progresses. Talking of seafronts and jewels in the crown, you see what I did there?
Very good link there, Guy.
We said it's nice to see stories that we've been working on for a while, moving on to the next stage. Now, just before Christmas, I wrote a lot of stories about some palm trees in Torquay. Overnight, almost, and it wasn't quite Armada Way, but it was Torquay's equivalent of Armada Way on a much smaller scale. 40 palm trees were cut down in the Italian gardens on Torquay seafront as part of a project which aims to restore the gardens because it's their centenary this year. Now, the palm trees hadn't been there for 100 years, which some other news outlets said 100-year-old palm trees felt. Not true.
Right.
They'd been there for 50 years at most. And they, to be fair, they were in a pretty dilapidated state because on the seafront they just get battered by the wind and by the salt and what have you. But there's been a report published this week, which was commissioned by the council, let's say, into what exactly happened in the decision-making process that led up to cutting down the trees. It'll go before Torbay Council's Overview and Scrutiny Committee next Wednesday, when I think there'll be quite a lively debate, to say the least. I've had a look at the report and written something about it as well. It unpicks everything that happened over the 3 years or so which led up to the felling of the trees. There were emails and discussions before the pandemic about what they might do with this garden. Let me just tell you exactly where it is. If you're driving along Torquay Seafront from the Paignton direction and you're just coming up to the bridge, the Palm Court Bridge, which is quite good, you come up to a set of traffic lights and on your left is where the Italian gardens are. It's just tucked away behind the wall there. But it all went cold because of the upheaval of the pandemic and some budget issues, and nothing happened. It was kind of put on the shelf for a couple of years. And then Swissco, which is the wholly owned company that the council owns, which deals with parks and gardens, recycling and waste, which took over from a previous company called Tortu. It's complicated, this, Ali. It's really, really complicated. But Swissco started play. You've gone to sleep over there.
I'm still with you.
Swissco started their planning for the centenary, and they went ahead and cut down the trees without telling anybody. Now, they thought they didn't have to tell anybody, because it says in their charter that they didn't have to tell anybody, to be fair. They point out the trees were in pretty bad shape, and there are going to be some new palms among 1,600 new plants in the new garden. But there was this whole business that what the report points out is that the left hand just didn't have any idea what the right hand was doing. There was no communication.
Got to bring the public with you on something like that.
Absolutely, precisely. There no referring to the officers or the cabinet before they went ahead. Mm. As you say, all it would have taken to avoid all this dreadful nationwide publicity would maybe have been one video on the council website from somebody saying, look, these trees are in a pretty poor state. We're going to cut them down and replace them with new ones in a lovely new garden. Mm. It's a shame, but they've got to go. Mm. And if they'd done that, there would have been still been a few people who would have said, leave them where they are.
Yes.
But people would have understood, and it could have just all could have been avoided. Lots of people on social media in that horrible echo chamber of social media saying somebody should be sacked, somebody should lose their job for it. I don't agree with that, especially in this economic climate. I don't want to see somebody thrown out of a job. They apologised. They've explained. What they need to do now is make a really good job of these gardens and make sure that these palms are there. So it's an interesting report. I think there'll be a bit of cut and thrust at the overview and scrutiny meeting.
Sounds like a fun meeting.
Next week it is. It certainly will be. Now, we still have a visit to the police museum to come, but I just wanted to have a little bit of a shameless free plug. For the moment, I have family members who are involved in fundraising for Marie Curie, which is the UK's leading end-of-life charity. And they're asking residents in Exeter to support the Great Daffodil Appeal by giving up a little bit of time to distribute the daffodil pins in exchange for donations throughout this month. Marie Curie, they provide hospice care in the comfort of people's own homes across the county. Money raised also funds support line and web chat. Georgia Brooks has been in touch. She's the community fundraiser of Devon. There's a collection at Morrison's on Prince Charles Road in Exeter almost every day for the first 2 weeks of March, and one on Exeter High Street on the 16th, which will be the first time they've collected in the city centre for some years. They desperately need more volunteers to take part. They'd love local businesses to organise collections. If you can help, you can call Georgia on 07515 133 895. Now, all of you listening did not have a pen and paper with you when I did that. So what I want you to do now is press the pause button and I'm going to give you that number again. So go on, press pause, go and get a pen and paper. Right, you're back in the room. The number you want, Georgia, 07515 133 895. Ali, take us to the police museum.
Right, so Guy, do you know the difference between a tipstaff and a truncheon?
I do not, but I have a feeling I'm about to.
All that up until the 1960s, there was not just one, but four police forces covering Devon, Cornwall and the Isles of Scilly.
I didn't know that either.
Well, this week I found out some fascinating facts from the curator of the newly opened mini museum of policing in Tavistock, Alison Holmes. The museum is a result of years of perseverance to find a premises where artefacts, documents and photographs charting the county's policing history and heritage can be displayed to the public. Here's Alison to tell us more about what's in there.
So all the objects and uniforms in here are from our collection. Even the ones you can try on are original police uniforms from our collections. We've got all sorts of things from the uniforms in cases right through to the ones you can try on, as well as a taser You can't play with that, though, sadly. And lots of information about communications devices, because, of course, in a rural county particularly, communication was a challenge until very recent times.
Yes, absolutely. And so what are some of the more unusual things that you've got here?
So we have a tip staff from prior to the Devon Constabulary. Tavistock itself had a borough force, and so we have a tip staff that predates the constabulary in Tavistock. A tip staff is the precursor to a truncheon. So initially it comes from the medieval tip stave, which was a long pointy stick. And it literally means a stick with a point on the end. So a tipstave was issued to the parish constable. They were appointed by the local magistrate or similar. And they were to keep peace in that area. It was their badge of office when they had no uniform, was their tipstave. And that continued in one form or another right through to the 1840s, when you had borough policemen based here in Tavistock. And they continue to be issued with these tip staves that by that point look more like a truncheon, although they're beautifully decorated. And in the intervening periods, there are some that had hollow centres so that you could keep the Riot Act in it. And the Riot Act was a real thing, and you had to read it word for word. If you got it wrong, it wasn't legally binding, and they used that to disperse crowds. But we also have modern body cams. So Devon and Cornwall were one of the first forces to adopt body cams and to trial them. So we've got one of the most up-to-date in here as well.
Yeah, we got some PhotoFit fact files. Tell me about those.
Ah, yes. So we've got some things for children and adults to play with, including our PhotoFit, which is all on a magnetic board, and it shows you just how difficult it is to make any photo fit actually look like a human being, let alone one you actually want it to look like. Of course, it's now all done using digital files, which makes life slightly easier and a lot more accurate, I find. But this is a nice way of looking back at that history and how people used to try and fit things together.
That's the old-fashioned police bike up there. Yeah, I don't suppose many people would want to be riding around on one of those anymore, not in this weather.
Especially not that one, because that one is a particularly large bicycle for a very tall policeman. He was 6'5" and based in Mary Tavy, just up the road from our museum. And that was the one on the wall is his second bicycle, and the one you can see in the photograph is his first one. That was a rally made specially for him because of his height. And yes, I think in Mary Tavy, I don't know if you've been there, but it's quite hilly. And he chose to retain his bicycle rather than move to a motorised version. So
really?
He didn't. Yeah, he chose not to ride a motorbike. So he moved to Bea Ferris instead, so he could retain his bicycle.
I love that.
And that's even more hilly.
It is. I don't think there's anywhere around here that hasn't got hills. You'd have to seriously move a long way.
Yeah.
Okay, great. So the uniform's over here. And tell me about the police box. I'm intrigued.
Okay, so the police box is something that people always ask us about. They're really well known because of Doctor Who. Ours is, in fact, I'm afraid, a mock-up. It's not real or original. It's one of the very few things in here that isn't. But it is based on a local police box. But it does look a lot like a TARDIS, and that's what most people call it. But police boxes used to be used by policemen to shelter in and also as points of contact. So they before radios, you'd need to make your way to a fixed phone line in order to call it back into your station and see if there were any messages to or from. So you use your police box, or in many places in our counties, in the city forces particularly, there were effectively a box mounted to a pole rather than even somewhere you could get shelter in. Sadly, they shelter was hard to come by, I think, in Devon and Cornwall.
That was Alison Holmes, curator of the Mini Museum of Policing in Devon and Cornwall, which is well worth a visit if you get down that way. Police and Crime Commissioner Alison Hernandez. There's too many Alisons.
Far too many Alisons. Confusing me.
Yeah, it is. So she did the honours of cutting the ribbon and declaring the museum open on Tuesday. This was followed by a short dedication to honour Trustee Bill Tupman, who played a pivotal role in founding the museum. Sadly, Bill died in March last year, just weeks before the lease on the Court Gate building was signed. I expect he was looking down on Tuesday and feeling proud.
I bet he was. But no, listen, you can go and try on police uniforms.
Yeah,
in there.
Oh, you can.
I'm in. I'm going to head over there in a minute. That sounds like a really nice little museum.
It is. It's so cute. And it's right under the court gate, which is under the arch in Tavistock. You go in a little creaky door, and it's quite fascinating looking at all that stuff and, finding out a little bit about the history. And apparently there's been loads of former police officers in there just excited. But they're going to be recording some of the old stories and anecdotes and having those available at some point. So that would be good as well.
That sounds really good.
Yeah.
I'm in. Great. That's all for now, folks. Thank you very much for listening to Devoncast, for taking us on your dog walk or your bus journey or your commute or in the bath, even, as somebody did say to us once.
Really?
Oh, seriously.
Okay.
You can find Devoncast on the Radio X website or wherever you usually find your podcast. Be sure that you subscribe so you can listen to the next Devoncast the minute it drops. And do contact us. Complain, suggest things we should be talking about. Our email is news@radiox.co.uk. That's radioexex.co.uk. We'll be back with another Devoncast, so it's good night from me.
And it's good night from me.
Good night.
Catch the latest episode of Devoncast every Friday at radiox.co.uk or wherever you get your podcasts.